Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Podcast. It's episode 4. I'm Scott Pianowski, your host, and we're bringing in one of our old favorites, one of our longtime favorites. I'll be honest with you. He's my favorite baseball writer. Not my favorite fantasy baseball writer. My favorite baseball writer. He's a longtime friend of mine. You know Gene McCaffrey from his work at The Athletic. You probably know him from his previous work at Wise Guy Baseball. And just as being one of the industry leaders, one of the greatest players, one of the guys. He's a guy who can write on intelligent level and yet appeal to anybody who's just more of a basic rudimentary player. I mean, he can appeal to any sophistication of the audience. So I'm just thrilled to have him here. I'm talking too much. Gene McCaffrey, hello.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me. Thanks for the kind words. Unfortunately, now I have to live up to them, right?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, Gene. I just hope we have a baseball season. How are you hanging in Colorado?
Okay. I mean, we're on sort of restricted work. Everybody's worried about business, but what can we do? We just got to ride it out and hope for the best.
Are you currently in draft mode? Are you going to hold off on the other stuff you're doing this year? What's your plan for the foreseeable future with your teams?
I'm actually doing a cut line, one of those 10-team sure. NFBC things right now. I'm in the middle of it. It's wonderful. They're fabulous. I love these things. They're so easy. I mean, they're not really going to be that easy because everybody's in the same boat. But it seems to be easier to plot a strategy and execute it, especially with 10 teams. I'm really enjoying it. This is my second one.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the Tout Wars auction, which was not this past weekend, but the previous weekend. And a few days before that, we had the Yahoo Friends and Family Draft. And I've just found it incredibly therapeutic just to be around my friends. I mean, I would have preferred to be around everybody in New York City. And obviously that didn't happen. It became a remote auction this year. And hats off to the Tout Wars crew for making that happen on, you know, really with no prep time at all. They were outstanding to do that. But just to be around everybody, even if it were virtual, was, I don't know, it felt good to me. And I need you guys around me. And you know, Gene, you made one of the biggest splashes in that auction. We all know, anybody who follows your work knows you're a Jacob deGrom guy. And in this 15-team mixed auction, you put your money where your mouth was. He's one of the earliest guys thrown out there. And you went up to $50. And put this in context, I think Gerrit Cole went for $40. So just explain, some people might get a little sticker shock when they see deGrom. Obviously a great pitcher, but you know, is he worth $50? Explain your rationale there.
Well, I mean, I don't know if he's worth $50, but to me, he was in this because I think he's the best pitcher. And I wanted to get the best starting pitcher because I think he has the most standings impact. The salary, as you know, I don't believe there's any rational pricing structure in mixed league auctions. The salary structure is dictated by money management more than anything else in the end game. So, I mean, there are some limits, but I don't think that it was worth it. I probably would have gone to 52 if somebody had said 51. But it goes to show, you know, somebody else went to 49, bid me all up. So I'm not utterly alone in thinking that this was the right thing to do. And there were certain things when I get in a mixed league auction that I want to do. One of them is get the best pitcher. I also wanted to get the best closer. I also wanted to get the best stolen base guy. I would have tried to get the best high OBP power hitter, except I can't figure out who he is.
It's interesting. You look at your roster. DeGrom was your first purchase for $50. You got Alberto Mondesi for $30, which checks that stolen base box. You also paid up for Trevor Story at $42, and you know, he's a five-category stud. I was one of the late bidders on him. And then you went with vanity closers. You have Hader and Asuna. I thought 22 and 18 were pretty reasonable prices. But when I'm looking at your team, with DeGrom going for 50, with Mondesi going for 30, Story for 42, there's an Aaron Judge sprinkled in there. You know, he's probably worth more given the shape of the season that we'll get if we actually have a season at all. This meant you were also going to have a ton of $1 players. And I wonder, we can get back to the big names in a second. This is a draft that had an unusually high number of $1 players. And so people may say, what's the big deal? I actually went a different route with my roster construction, and I had fewer $1 players than most teams, but I actually thought that the guys I was getting for $2 to $5 were considerably better. Maybe this is my folly. I thought like Cesar Hernandez, you know, for a few dollars, or Kevin Newman for a few dollars were a lot better than maybe some of the $1 guys. Do you think it's just folly to think that, you know, a $5 player or $3 player is worth more than a $1 player? I do agree that if you're going to overspend somewhere, do it on a player you want. You know, don't overspend on some scrub at the end of a draft. But, I mean, how do you feel having all these $1 guys on your roster?
Not good. Usually when I come out of these auctions, I'm absurdly pleased with myself, and I was not this time. But what happened was with Osuna, I really didn't want to get him. I was bidding him up. I hit plus one at $16, and all of a sudden I had him at $18. So that put a real crimp in my offense. Now, yeah, I think you're right. It's always good to have options. Now, whether the $1 player or whether the $4 player is actually better than the $1 player remains to be seen, but it's always good to have the option of bidding two or three or five for a particular player at the end, which I did not have. However, I did know that there were going to be a lot of really good $1 players at the end because of the way the auction was going. I could see it. Still, I would rather have had a little more money and I would not have bid $18 on Osuna. I had him at heart at 17, but then that sort of screwed me as far as the offense was concerned. And I'll tell you something else. There were a lot of things in this draft that really surprised me. I mean, I did not expect to get Luzardo for $13 or Montas for $13. I thought that they were going to go, if either of them had gone for $20, I would not have been surprised, and certainly expected them to go for like $18. But then, bang, there they are on my team. So I said, okay, what am I going to do here? What I should do is get the best pitching now. And if I have to have holes on offense, I'll leave my holes at first base, corner, and outfield and see if I can fab my way or trade my way into a better offense. And then the other thing I decided to do was I said, okay, now something's got to give on the offense. What's going to give? And I decided that I was just going to go for home runs and forget on base percentage. So you can see in my draft, I've got like Odor for $3 and who else?
Jonathan Salvador Scope, Perez. $5.
Salvador Perez was absolutely key to my plan, mm-hmm. because that was another thing. I said, okay, now I'm limited. I might as well get strong catching. I already had Garver, who I love. And I said, now Salvador Perez is the key guy for me. Otherwise, I have to punt catcher and go to like Roberto Perez for a buck, which I really didn't want to do. So I'm not thrilled with my auction. My team is definitely a work in progress. I was looking at the other teams, and I do not have the best team, yours included, but I think I do have the best pitching, so that's a place to start.
Now let me run down some of the guys you got for a dollar, and if there's anybody particularly here that you're excited about, tell me about them. Tommy La Stella, Miguel Cabrera, Randall Grichuk, Gregory Polanco, Will Myers, Cole Calhoun, Taiwan Walker, Homer Bailey. Who's the home run here, you think?
Oh, I don't know if there's any home runs there, but I think they're all going to be pretty solid. I think La Stella is going to score 100 runs, so I took him for that reason. That reason alone for a dollar. I think that Will Myers for a dollar is... I guess it's a little bit risky, but last year he went for a lot more, don't you? I'm not crazy about Calhoun, but I did get Josh Rojas as a reserve, and I tried to protect my speed in the reserve rounds by taking Victor Reyes, Josh Rojas, and Jose Peraza, and I think between them, among those three, I think one of them will pop. And
The reason why. A main reason why, anyway, that I tried to avoid $1 players, I do have three of them, is I just know it's part of my personality that if I get stuck with no leverage in the end game, I can't nominate anybody good because I'm not going to get that player. And then I have to try to think of mediocre players who people won't want to bid on, who I can slip through, and it's just going to frustrate me. And the moment I throw out a guy that I think I can get through for a buck and somebody at the last minute goes two, and I'm just sitting there with my hands tied, now I got to wait a whole nother round and watch all these guys and have no impact on that. It just drives me bananas. Now, again, the trade-off here is that you have better players. If you don't have any leverage in the end game, it's because you exerted your leverage in the middle game or in the early game, and you probably have a roster that reflects that. But I just know it doesn't fit my personality. I just don't handle that very well. Maybe I want control in a setting where control is kind of an illusion anyway.
Well, of course, if I'm in an only league, I'm purely spread the risk. It's a complete. I use a completely different strategy. Mm-hmm. I don't mind in the mixed leagues because I know that pretty good players are going to be available for a buck. It has to be. I agree with you to the extent that it's nice to have the money to get the players that you particularly want for $3 or $4, if that's what it takes. And, you know, I mean, there's a ton of guys like that also, and they probably are a little bit better on paper than my $1 guys. But, you know, I was looking at through the projection systems, and out of the four main projection systems, my team has between 307 and 322 home runs, as it is. So I think I'm going to compete.
You certainly have a lot of power. I was looking at your roster and just seeing what everybody did last year. Everybody had double-digit home runs and well into the double digits. And I don't even know if that's a differentiation thing anymore because, you know, power is all over the place. What can we do as far as the spike last year in power and this year, and maybe the ball won't be as juicy? I don't really know a way to apply that. But, I mean, have you changed or tweaked your approach to how much power is enough?
No, because I've always been a guy who my philosophy is when you think you have enough power, get another power hitter.
Right.
And it's always been that way. And it remains that way because they're four category events. It's not as important. You know, they're a hit, I guess, in an on base percentage leagues, but it's still a hit, you know. So, yeah, it's a four category event. I think that's the place where you have to. We have to keep your focus and never let it go. So, I mean, I expect that if there is a less juicy ball this year, that it will be that the effects will be more or less across the board. And I don't think there's any predictability in it because, you know, people say, oh, wow, well, you know, when he hits them, they go. Of course, that's true. But they also just miss, you know, Pete Alonso just misses some balls that become high fly balls that are home runs with this ball and that are caught on the warning track because they're hit 300 feet high. So I think the effect is going to be much more across the board than people say, with the possible exception of the guys who, a guy like La Stella, who I didn't draft because I expected him to have power. I expect his power to be down this year because he's just, it's just not in his hard hit rates. I mean, I looked at the other stats to do that, but I think the effect is going to be pretty much across the board and therefore irrelevant for us.
Yeah, you think those on-base percentage skills for La Stella, if he lands the key for that offense, if he lands batting in front of Trout, that's where you could see him crossing home plate a bunch of times.
Right. I expect him to bat lead off as he did last year. So. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Lizardo earlier, and he's the type of player that I almost never roster, in part because he's young and he's buzzy. And I think about like Vladimir Guerrero Jr. last year, not a perfect comp, but when I started to see him get drafted around Anthony Rendon, I'm like, people are crazy. I don't care how good he might be someday. Anthony Rendon's really good right now. Now, with a guy like Lizardo, some of the calculus is a little bit different. I mean, he's a pitcher. How many innings is he going to throw? But $13 I thought was a great price. I expected with his recent spring start right before this auction in people's memory and just the fact that he was a buzzy player in a big park on a good team with a good defense, I thought he would go a lot higher. So when he came out, I don't know if I even left the room or I just relaxed a little bit thinking, okay, this is going to chase into the 20s. And I think you get a good deal at $13.
Yeah. It may be one of those things where he was so buzzy that everybody said, well, he's the buzzy guy, but I don't mind. I mean, I know he's got great stuff. He looked great in the spring so far with the presumably shortened season. He's relatively more valuable, I think. So, I was shocked to get him at 13. I had really no expectation of having him on my team, but I'm happy to have him.
It's funny, you have one of the post-type guys who was kind of one of the former Lizardos in Julio Urias, who's had injury issues, and we don't know how the Dodgers are going to use him, but I thought him at $6 has a ton of room for profit.
Yeah, again, another guy that I had no real expectation of getting. I thought he was going to double figures, but at that point of the auction, it's so strange the way everybody manages their money. I mean, you want something, so you have to give up something else. And I think that most people prefer to get the hitters and and let the pitchers go. And in my situation, I really had no choice but to zag while they were zigging. I wasn't planning on doing that, but I figured, okay, if this is the what they're going to give me, this is what I have to take. And then there is some offensive sacrifice, and I'm just going to have to play that by ear and really manage the hell out of this team.
You mentioned liking Mitch Garver. You got him for $17. It's, as everybody knows, it's not a strong year for catching. We need two starters. There's 15 teams. You do the math. That's 30 catchers. Talk about what you expect from him this year.
Well, he's another guy that he's not getting any respect at all. I mean, if you look at his hard hit data, it's fantastic. And I see that people, you know, this is a guy who hit 31 home runs in, you know, 350 plate appearances. And I look at the projections, everybody's picking him to hit 19 and 18 and 21. And I say, wait a minute, he's going to play a lot more. They got rid of Castro. I mean, Astudillo is not a, you know, looks to me like a regular backup catcher.
Not a catcher. I mean,
so, yeah. I mean, I don't see what in the world is going to stop this guy from getting, you know, 450 plate appearances. And how is he not going to hit 30 home runs? I mean, the skills are there. I mean, it's not a question of, you don't hit 31 home runs in 350 plate appearances as a fluke. It's not really possible. Do you think? Maybe am I wrong there? Do you disagree?
I think everything you're saying is on point. I kind of wish I'd gone $18. Although the catcher market for the guys I got, I thought was reasonable. But I think he's been a little bit underrepped in the draft season I've seen so far.
I think it's perfectly reasonable to go $2 catchers this year. I think there's enough guys who are, you know, if you get the right guys. But I think it's a reasonable strategy. I, you know, as we always say, it's not the strategy. It's who you get to implement the strategy that mm-hmm. makes it effective or not.
You talked about how you were going to punt OBP mid-draft and get as much power as you could. And Rougned Odor certainly fits that profile. New park this year, you know, for years we've been enjoying what goes on in Arlington, that jet stream. Now they're moving indoors. I guess we have to consider it a neutral park until we know more. Talk about what you expect from Texas and what you expect from Odor.
Well, I'm assuming a neutral park, so I'm assuming that he'll hit a few fewer home runs, but still, that lead makes 25. He is the kind of player that could lose his job, so I kind of backed him up with Peraza, and also he's my utility guy, so I also have Scope, who's kind of like Odor himself.
The right-handed, yeah, Odor, sure.
Right, and but I like Scope because there are no fears of him losing his job this year. And he's been a very consistent 25 home run guy. I think that the Tigers are going to be a little bit better offensively than people think they are. May not keep him from losing 100 games, but I think that I'm also expecting Cabrera to bounce back. I know he's having a good spring, to which someone said he had a good spring last year, too. I said, okay, all right. But, you know, he is Miguel Cabrera, and I want to see a little more evidence that this Hall of Famer, one of the greatest right-hand hitters of all time, is really finished at his age, not an age when Hall of Famers typically have lost it.
You know, I was so in on that argument last year, and right. I ended up with a lot of Joey Votto and a few Miguel Cabreras, and it didn't work out. And this year, I just kind of backed off it. You know, it occurs to me, I wasn't thinking this way at the draft, but you know, with all these $1 players, we're stepping into a incredibly strange season. This is a unique season because it's going to be a partial season of some sort if we get a season at all. And maybe that will just lead to, and we're going to have a long delay before we even think about Fab guys. So maybe there'll just be so much chaos in this season that it will be an advantage to have a flexible roster and cuttable guys because you're going to want to be aggressive on the market anyway. I mean, maybe the point would be, okay, fine. I have all these $1 guys, you know, a bunch of them won't hit. The worst thing you can do is get attached to the bottom of your roster anyway. You should be turning those guys over. So maybe this is a roster that might fit the chaos 2020 season, if unintentionally, better than another strategy.
Yeah, that's a good point, and I think there is some validity to it. There's going to be less time for guys who start out hot to cool off. You know, I have always, one of my faults as a player is that I fall in love with my players. And that's why I kind of like being in this insecure position. I have to be much more aggressive with my early fabbing. And I'm kind of glad about that.
Yeah, one of my strategies, I always say that if you never regretfully cut somebody, then you're playing too conservative. It's like never getting caught bluffing in poker. I mean, sometimes you just have to do something that exposes you to risk. And you always say, you know, if you're not willing to be wrong, you don't really have a chance to be very much right either. And
right. You want to get caught bluffing really early in the poker game, right?
Oh, yeah. The advertising is certainly great. You talked a little bit earlier about exit velocity for some hitters. I'm just curious just how you're, if this is a really deep question, but just in a general sense, how has your analysis changed over the last year or two with all the new data we have coming into the game?
Well, I think that this is the best place to start that we've ever had as far as looking at players. You know, I remember, you know, 10, 15 years ago talking with the late, great Steve Moyer about this. Oh, how I wish we had exit velocity off the bat. And he said, well, it's coming. And now it's here. And I think, you know me, I've always railed against the concept of one number, even though this really isn't one number. It's a series of numbers. But nevertheless, I think this is the best place to start our analysis that we've ever had. And so I'm really grateful to StatCast and Baseball Savant for getting this information out to us and letting us use it. And as I say, it's not the be-all and end-all, but it's the best place to start in analyzing both pitchers and hitters.
Do you think it's more valuable as from a hitting tool or from a pitching tool?
Probably a little more valuable from a hitting tool, if only because more times with a pitcher, if there's anomalies with their exit velocity, it might be something mechanical, or they might have been pitching through an injury. And, you know, pitchers are more or less always hurt. So that can reflect in the data where it's not really relevant the following year. I think it's less true with hitters, although it happens sometimes with them too. For example, Miguel Cabrera, with him, it's all about his legs. If his legs are in great shape, he's going to be Miguel Cabrera. If his legs are not in great shape, he's going to hit 280 with 13 home runs. But that's only because he's great. If you're not quite that good, then you stink and your exit velocity is going to be not what it should be. I think it's a little bit better for hitters, but still very relevant for pitchers.
Yeah, I think our mutual friend Michael Salfino, he likes to say that hitters control their outcomes. They control their destiny more than a pitcher does. So I guess that would line up with how Mike might view these things. Now, I want to take this moment to have you make me feel better about my own roster. I actually feel pretty good about the team I assembled in Tout Wars, but I have a very old team. I have a bunch of guys who have all sorts of hardware that they won several years ago. Zach Greinke won a Cy Young Award a million years ago. Clayton Kershaw has been a MVP and Cy Young Award winner. Chris Bryant has won an MVP. But, you know, in the case of Greinke and Kershaw, you know, they're on the back nine of their careers. You know, Greinke's in his late 30s now. And I have a really old team. Charlie Blackmon's a good player, but he doesn't want to run anymore. Whit Merrifield's stolen bases dropped last year. I mean, do I have too many old guys on this team? Paul Goldschmidt's 32.
I'm not crazy about Goldschmidt, but on the whole, I love your team. I love Rizzo. I love Bryant. I love Greinke. Charlie Blackmon is another one. I mean, people kind of think that he's going to, I don't know, do they think he's going to fall off the earth? Because I certainly don't. No, I think you have a really good team. You're one of the teams to beat. You also have Buster Posey, who I've been sort of, at $2, how wrong can you be?
Yeah, that's how I felt. You're right. Yeah. How bad can that be, right?
Yeah. I mean, he's got the lineup slot. You know, again, he's a Hall of Famer. If he's physically shot, that's a different story. But as far as we know, he's not physically shot. He also was hitting this spring. So, I mean, that tells me that he's healthy. And no, I think you have one of the teams to beat. I like Tucker Barnhart. You know, if you're going to dollar out a catcher, I think you did about as well as you can do.
I like that he had a totally different approach in the second half. He was healthy, and he produced as a solid, bona fide, you know, major league hitter. You know, he looked like he belonged in the majors. Where in the first half, he didn't. He was mechanically screwed up. He was hurt. And I think at his peak, he could be a good player. I think he could be a top 12 catcher, and, you know, to get him for a dollar, I felt pretty good about. I think Hernandez is really going to be a good buy at $2 too. I mean, he gets on base. He has some pop. He has some speed. Cleveland certainly needs him, and they got him. They're going to play him. I would take – he's one of – if you're going budget on the middles, he's one of the guys I like in the late stages of a draft. You know, Gene, you're a Colorado native, and you've always – I always give you credit for you figured out Coors Field, I think, before a lot of people did. And you understood that when people would panic, when a guy would leave Coors and then a guy would get traded away from the Rockies and people would go, oh, no, now he's the sum of his road stats. You know, no, it doesn't work that way. Well, I thought it was interesting last year that in the middle of the season, I don't know if this is news or noise. So I'm going to ask you to kind of solve it for me. It seems that the Rockies started taking batting practice differently to prepare for road trips and to get their timing right. And I'm just curious, do you think there's anything to them maybe solving the problem of how to handle switching from Coors to the road? And does that make you any less interested or more interested in Colorado hitters this year?
Up to a point. It's not Coors Field, by the way. It's Denver, because before Coors Field, the same thing happened.
Right, sure. Mile High Stadium, right?
These guys, their road numbers were just horrible. It was actually my brother who first pointed this out to me, and it was way back in like 1994. And he said there's something about it that makes them worse on the road than they really are. And I said, and then the subsequent history was right there from the start, you know, with Galarraga and Bichette and Vinny Castillo. You know, they weren't superstars when they left Coors, but they were much better hitters than their road numbers showed. That's still true. And by the way, the thing that you said about them taking batting practice is definitely true. They've been aware of it for a long time, and they're trying to, you know, they phrased it. I had this email conversation with Dick Monfort, as a matter of fact, in which he phrased it as they get into bad habits at home. And so the batting practice on the road, it was an effort to minimize the bad habits that they were getting into in Coors, which kind of
vague. To be specific here, it's not just taking generic batting practice. They're doing some actual specialized batting practice that simulates the type of off-speed pitches that they're having trouble to adjusting to on the road, that type of thing.
Right, and taking that batting practice on the road, mm-hmm. As opposed to, you know, extra work at Coors. They switch their extra work to on the road. And I think the results are there a little bit. I haven't gone, you know, done a deep dive into it. But they have been better on the road in the last couple of years than they had been before. So there are some benefits to it.
You know, last year, a player that both of you and I were high on was Garrett Hampson. And he came out of the gate really slow. And we know the Rockies don't have a lot of patience sometimes with guys who, you know, God forbid, go in a 3-day slump. And so he was dropped in every league and forgotten about. And then he really came on like gangbusters at the end of the season. I think he picked up in August and had a terrific September. But as always, Colorado seems to have more offensive players than they have starting slots. I'm just curious with Hampson, with McMahon, with guys that, you know, if we could get something of a regular job, you'd be pretty excited. But I guess the downside with these guys is that they're not playing at all. Neither one of us got any of those lesser Colorado hitters in this auction, but how are you playing those guys this year?
With deep suspicion. I just don't know, and therefore I'm reluctant to take a chance unless they're deeply discounted. I love the appeal of Hilliard, but I just think he's going to strike out too much. And he was striking out in the spring. And so that puts center field up for grabs, but it gives Hampson a path to playing time because he is really fast. And you need really fast guys in the outfield, and they don't have really, you know.
And he's versatile, too. He can play all over the field, too.
Right. Right, but I'm thinking in terms of everyday at-bats.
Sure.
Because I think they want McMahon to play every day. They would prefer not to platoon at second base.
We mentioned earlier that Trevor Story at $42 was one of your big-name purchases, the top player on your offense. Switching to a draft standpoint, how early is too early for Trevor Story in 2020 if you were in a draft league?
Oh, he's definitely a first-rounder.
I mean, top five? Six,
not
seven?
For me, because I would take DeGrom with the first pick.
Really? Okay.
In fact, I'm kind of hoping that I was kind of hoping to get to pick first in my NFBC main event so I could do that. I wouldn't take him
over.
Tell
me this just so we're talking.
The guys I would take, I would take DeGrom, Trout, Acuna, Yelich, and Bellinger. And after that, Story's up for grabs. He's just as good as anybody.
Yeah, you know, one of my NFBC leagues where I had the KDS, I tried to set it up so I would have a slot that made sense for Story because I really liked him as a first-round pick. And I thought, okay, I pick in the middle of the first round, I'll get him. And then Mookie Betts was still available. And I started thinking, and maybe this is a mistake, but I looked at the shortstop pool and I felt like you could do well at any price point at shortstop. I've never seen – remember shortstop – we're old enough to remember when shortstop was the defensive position. If any shortstop hit, you threw a parade and hugged strangers. You were just so happy to have that. But a lot of these guys couldn't hit at all. And now I feel like they're just coming out of the woodwork. And then you add the position eligibility of some guys who aren't even shortstops, but they still qualify. I thought, well, I can't say no to Betts. I know he's going from Fenway to L.A., but that lineup is so deep. And right. He is such a high floor. It hurt me to not take Story, but I felt like I could do better at shortstop on the cheaper side. I still want a lot of Story this year, but Betts, do you think I made a mistake taking Betts over Story?
No. I mean, I think it's arguable, but no, definitely not a mistake. He's in that ballpark. To me, it's six of one, half a dozen of the other. Soto is another one. Who belongs, I think, in that class. Because I
don't know, his ability to spit on those borderline pitches is unbelievable. To take pitches that he can't do anything with, and then he gets a pitch that he can hammer, and he hammers it.
Yeah, I mean, all over the field, you know, 100-plus miles an hour. I mean, he's awesome. And I tried to get him. I thought really – I think he went for 45 in Tout Wars, and I really thought hard about bidding that extra buck. But I did let him go, so – but Al Melker got him for 45, and that's a good guy to get.
Yeah, he's also your athletic colleague who bid you up on DeGrom. As I joked in the chat room, I said it was athletic on athletic crime. We're talking to Gene McCaffrey, a longtime publisher of Wise Guy Baseball and baseball columnist at The Athletic. And Gene, let's think again of a draft mindset. We know you're a DeGrom guy, but let's say you're in an NFBC-style draft or Yahoo-style draft, and you're near the end of the first round, and DeGrom's off the board. Are you likely to take a big-name pitcher there or maybe even two? And which types of guys would you be targeting, assuming DeGrom is not an option?
Yeah, I would. I would take a pitcher there. Verlander was at the top of my list. Now I think I would probably go back to him, assuming that he's going to, you know, I don't hear any more bad news. A guy I like more than a lot of other people is Strasburg. I especially love him as a number two. I did do a draft champions league where I was picking from the 11th spot, and DeGrom was, of course, gone. But in that team, I had written a column for The Athletic about a whole team of last year's bums. And my thinking was that you could start with two aces. So I took Verlander and Strasburg and then filled out the rest of the team basically with all last year's bums. But that was, you know, I think it was worth doing as an experiment. Whether I would do it in a main event, I don't know. But yes, I'm definitely taking an ace pitcher with one of my first two picks. And what we have to do, Scott, is we have to talk Salfino out of his crazy strategy of not taking any pitchers. I'm not talking about the cut line game. That's fine. In fact, you shouldn't take pitchers in that. But in a main event draft champion style league, you have to take an edge pitcher. You have to do it because otherwise you're buried. And the other factor is that the difference between the hitters in the second and third round and the hitters in the fourth round is not very big. What's the difference between Matt Olson and Anthony Rizzo?
Nothing.
Yeah, basically nothing. You know, that's my thinking, and I'm going to stick by it because you got to get balance. And, you know, Michael wants to take Jose Berríos as his ace. Well, that's great, but, you know, he's going to be my number three pitcher, and I really haven't sacrificed anything. You know, what's the difference between who's another guy to take? You know, Ozzy Albies and Keston Hira.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no difference between them. Javier Baez, who goes even later. You know, these Javier Baez, this guy's got on the first round.
So I love, Baez because there's always a bias against guys who don't take a lot of walks. And as you say, you know, like Tim Anderson, right? I mean,
right.
Yeah, he swings at anything, but you know what? He puts it in play, and it becomes a good result a lot of the time. That's a good thing.
Right. Moncada.
Sure.
Moncada is a guy. I mean, the basic reason for his tremendous season last year was that he stopped taking so many strikes. I mean, I think he was called out on strikes an inordinate number of times, not to mention falling behind in the count, mm-hmm. Which is the biggest edge in baseball, ahead in the count and behind in the count, is over 400 points in OPS. I mean, that is huge. It's a big DFS thing, by the way, for the umpires. But, you know, it's not a question of strike zone judgment. In almost every at-bat, the pitcher has to throw you a strike at some point. If you're ready for it and you hit it, you're going to have a good year, and you can hit. And if you got the hit tool, which obviously he does, it's not a question of, well, they're just not going to throw him strikes. That's way overblown. In the vast majority of cases, the pitcher has to throw strikes, and if he doesn't, the manager's going to pull him.
It's so frustrating to me. Anytime I see one of my hitters take a fastball right down Broadway for strike one, it's like, okay, there's probably the best pitch you're going to get to hit in the at-bat. You didn't offer at it. Now you're behind. Now he has the leverage for the rest of the at-bat. It just drives me crazy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the king of this was J.D. Drew.
Oh, I know. I mean,
how many 3-1 fastballs this guy took right down the middle? Why, JD? Why did you take that pitch? You could have hit it 450 feet.
Yeah. But I'll let you know, by the way, you're talking about starting pitching and how some of our strategies differ with our mutual friend, Michael Salfino. When Mike and I on the podcast that we do together, when we disagree on things, if I know that you agree with me, I always bring you out as like the hammer, as the tiebreaker.
I know. I listen to your podcast all the time. I listen to you guys all the time, and I really appreciate that you do that. It's fun.
Well, the great thing is, because Mike will be convinced I'm crazy, but if I have you on my side, it seems to soften him up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's right when it comes to the cut line championship. I don't know if you've played any of those things, but the scoring system is definitely skewed towards hitters.
Sure.
So, and it's great fun to be able to draft these monster teams when you don't have to pay attention to the pitching, and you can still get good guys. I mean, there's still plenty of good pitchers left, especially if you look at it in terms of, well, can this guy have several good two-start weeks? Because that's really what matters in this game.
Yeah, I'm in a best ball draft where I loaded up on hitting. I think I actually did take one ace. It might have been DeGrom in the second round, for all I know. But after that, I just said, I'll just take a bunch of guys I think are going to start a lot. I'm getting the best of their performances because it's perfect scoring. You don't have to set any lineups. So I just went with the best hitters I could get and then a bunch of volume pitchers in the second part of my draft.
Right, and I also took I think you should have at least four closers, maybe five. Because in the one-start weeks, most, you know, any guy who gets two saves in a week is going to beat most one-start pitchers. So it's nice to have that option, that mix where you can, where you got plenty to choose from. It's all about those best ball scorings. It's all about sensational. I want all the home run hitters. I want, you know, the guys who get four home runs in a week. The guy can get you two wins in a week. So you really want to pay attention to the starters that you get to have them be on good teams.
And it's just fun to be able to draft without adding the extra maintenance and the extra multi-feed. So you get the joy of the drafting. And even with a slow draft, you get to maybe research your pick or shape your team the way you want, but then you don't have the extra work during the season. And you get to still enjoy it, especially if you draft a great team, you'll enjoy watching it. It doesn't matter what the format is. Gene, you and I both love music, rock music, for a long time. We've had you on the podcast before. We've had some long corridors into music. I don't know if we have time for that today, but not that long ago, you got me into the Raveonettes. And I'm not going to have you on one of my podcasts without getting a recommendation from you. So find me another Raveonettes to listen to.
I don't know if you probably know the band The Black Lips.
I don't.
They got some fame because Sean Ono Lennon produced one of their records.
Okay.
But they're old. They have a new album out, but they're older stuff. Check out this song, the live version of a song called Boone, as in Daniel from Boone, Kentucky. They're a really good kind of song-oriented, loud garage rock. You'll like them. And then for old stuff, you can't go wrong with Hank Ballard and the Midnighters. They're swinging band, fantastic voice, just great, great to listen to.
It makes me sad that we don't have Steve Moyer and Laura Michaels with us, because they would talk music with us until we're blue in the face. And they were both really good musicians themselves, as you are. If you've never heard Gene McCaffrey Wailway on the guitar, go do a search on The End and fire that up on YouTube. You will thank me later for that. Gene McCaffrey of The Athletic is our guest. And now we're going to transition to our silly little draft. Today, we're going to draft baseball players in strange uniforms. We're going to, in honor of Tom Brady, who, of course, is a football player, headed to Tampa Bay. He's going to look strange in that uniform. Today, Gene and I are going to go five rounds and just take baseball players who look really strange on a team for any number of reasons. And I'm going to give you the first pick, Gene.
Okay. Now, I got to go old with this stuff because I'm too cynical and jaded now to be shocked by anything. So the first one I'm going to take is Wade Boggs as a Yankee.
It's funny you say Boggs, because I actually had him listed on my list, but I had Boggs in Tampa Bay, and I wrote in capital letters, actually anybody in a Tampa Bay uniform. I think Boggs looked crazy in Tampa Bay. I think Canseco didn't look right there. Manny Ramirez had like 20 at-bats with Tampa Bay. I think anybody who gets traded to the Rays probably looks at themselves in the mirror. There's been stories of people who get traded from the Yankees to other teams, and they feel like they're wearing a car, you know, just a CYO uniform or something. I feel like something about that Tampa Bay uniform doesn't look right to me.
Right. Yeah. Although now I think players are happy to go there. They should be.
My first round pick is going to be, and again, you know, skewing a little bit older, but Reggie Jackson on the Orioles. I mean, this is a guy who, known as being a Yankee, even though he was only there for 5 years. He had a great run with the Athletics and ended up in Oakland, but he spent that one bridge year in Baltimore. You know, Finley got rid of all of his players. The free agency was coming. And Reggie and that bird thing. The only reason I even knew it growing up, because it was a little bit before my time, is that there was a Sports Illustrated cover of Reggie in that uniform. It just always looked strange to me.
Yeah, okay, that's completely legit. Ready for my number two?
Yep, go ahead.
I'm going way back at a poignant history. Kurt Flood as a Washington Senator, because he was the guy. I loved that Cardinal team, and I was shattered when he was traded to the Phillies and he refused to report, and eventually played a few games for the Senators and retired, and that to me was just not right.
I mean, everybody who's making big money in baseball today owes a huge debt of gratitude to Marvin Miller and Kurt Flood and the people before them who were willing to give up their own, you know, good in the common day to what could be available later on. I mean, it's interesting too. I think the Cardinals actually have one of the two or three greatest uniforms in baseball. I hope they never change it. I think it's a fantastic uniform. I think almost anybody looks great in it.
Yes.
You picked somebody who went to the Washington Nationals, of course, a team that doesn't exist anymore. So I'll stick with that theme and pick somebody from a team that doesn't exist. Pete Rose. Okay, he went from the Reds to the Phillies, and those colors are kind of similar. So he looked pretty good in a Phillies uniform. And then Phillies didn't want him anymore. Pete wanted to chase the hit record. He went to Montreal and spent a few months with the Expos. And that he just looked goofy as hell in that. I actually liked the goofy Montreal uniform. For years, I thought that the M on the hat was an ELB. I thought it was like French for something.
Yeah.
I didn't know it was an M, but Pete Rose just never looked right in that uniform.
Yeah, you're right. So my number three is Mark McGwire as a Cardinal, because it signified the end of an era as far as the Cardinals were concerned. I mean, since before World War II, the Cardinals were this kind of team. We have high average, really great fielders. We get enough pitching. We're really fast. And basically, that was the Cardinals from Stan Musial's rookie opening day till Mark McGwire. And at that point, they changed their entire direction. So I think that there's a historical significance to it. That's why I chose it.
Interesting. You know, I always thought it was funny in the 80s when they had that team of Jackrabbits and then they had Jack Clark. Like, Clark would hit 30 home runs and the rest of the team would hit 30.
Right. Those were great teams. Really fun to watch.
The year Tommy Herr, I think, drove in 110 runs. He only hit 8 home runs.
That's right.
Just It's crazy, crazy stats. They were fun teams. My third round pick, I'm going to pick part of this exercise is sometimes a well-known player played on a team. You don't even remember it. And I don't remember Kirk Gibson on the Pirates at all, and which is kind of funny because Kirk Gibson looks like a Pirate, right? He's unshaven, he's swashbuckling, and he just looks like he's come out from sea, you know? But I guess he went from Detroit to the Dodgers, and then I guess the Dodgers let him go. He became a free agent, and he went to the Pirates, not for very long. He was also on the Royals for a short amount of time. My mind just can't wrap itself around Kirk Gibson wearing a Pirates uniform.
Yeah, I don't remember it at all. I have no recollection of that. My next guy is Tom Seaver, as a Red or a White Sox, because he was the Mets.
Or a Red Sox, for that matter.
Or a Red Sox, that's right. But to me, he was the Mets. And he's basically driven out of town by Dick Young, the sports writer. He was a really good writer, but he was not a very nice person.
And he had a ton of clout in this. You know, Young wielded a poison pen, and he had a lot of influence in what did they call it, the Midnight Massacre, when Seaver was traded in 77?
Yeah, that's right. Though, to his credit, Dick Young is the guy who got Whitey Herzog his first job as a major league manager, because Dick Young and Whitey Herzog was a guy who would tell you what you wanted. You ask a question, he would give you an answer, and he was not diplomatic. And Dick Young loved that. And when Whitey Herzog was a third base coach for the Mets, Dick Young said, "Stick with me, kid. I'm going to make you a manager." And he did.
I didn't know that story about Herzog and Young. Fourth round, I'll go a little bit more modern. I'm going to pick Ken Griffey Jr. on the White Sox. Hey. Look, you think Griffey, you think Seattle. And then he went to Cincinnati. It wasn't the greatest fit going back home. Obviously, that's where his father played. And then by the time he got to Chicago, he was beefier. He wasn't a center fielder anymore. He was kind of getting old. It's kind of like the young Elvis, old Elvis thing, right? I feel like we saw old Elvis on the White Sox. When I think of Griffey, I want young Elvis. I want to think about Griffey, flying through the air in Seattle and, with that beautiful swing. So it's just hard for me to think about him in a White Sox uniform.
Right. Absolutely. And then my last pick is, for very similar reasons, Dale Murphy in any other uniform but a Brave.
Because he was on the Rockies, tried to get to 400 home runs, but his swing was totally, totally toast at that point.
He lost it quickly. I mean, he is arguably a Hall of Famer.
And should he be? I was going to ask you that. Would you put him in? If you had a vote, would you vote for Dale Murphy?
I think I would, because, two MVPs and plenty of other good seasons, I think it's enough.
It's funny. I'm generally on a borderline case with guys. I tend to be out. But if somebody's won two major awards, like if they put Johan Santana in because he had a peak, or Dale Murphy in because he had a peak, or Roger Maris has the most important record in baseball, and he won two MVPs. I think that's probably enough for me, no matter if the rest of his career was just Hall of Very Good. I don't know. Those guys, I'd have no problem with any of those guys in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, it's an argument for the lower echelon and upper echelon Hall of Famers that several people have made over the years.
Well, stick with the theme. I'll name a guy who I think should be in the Hall of Fame, and I think maybe he will be someday, a player ahead of his time, Dwight Evans. My favorite player growing up in the Red Sox, was a great on-base percentage guy when it wasn't talked about much. Obviously a terrific fielder, and everybody knew that. He ended his career on the Orioles, and I'm not picking on the Orioles here. It's just, Dwight Evans to me is a member of the Red Sox. So he'll be my final pick. I'm passing up some great picks. We didn't pick Mike Piazza. Everybody loves to point out he was on the Marlins, Steve Carlton on the Indians. I think Ichiro on any team but the Mariners looks wrong. I think anybody looks bad in a Marlins uniform. And Daryl Strawberry and the Giants, I couldn't wrap my mind around that one either.
Yeah, they're all good picks.
All right, Gene, tell our listeners how they can keep up with Gene McCaffrey.
Well, I'm writing for The Athletic, although I'm on hiatus until the virus thing dies down, and we hope that it does die down and as fast as possible. That's where you'll be able to follow me. Please do ask questions, challenge me.
Amen to that, my friend. Well, I've enjoyed this talk as I always do. I hope I get to see you in person soon, and we have a baseball season to talk about. For our guest today, Gene McCaffrey, again, he's my favorite baseball writer. You can check this guy out, read his stuff. He's got a whole bunch of prep stuff over at The Athletic. Their baseball coverage is outstanding. Get you ready for your season, whenever the draft happens to be for you or your auction. For Gene, for our producers over at Yahoo, I'm Scott Pianowski. We'll talk to you next week with another great baseball guest. Everybody hang in there, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening.